The adventure of Advent is one part memory and one part hope. 11 or 12 days ago, there was carried into our sanctuary this beautiful pine tree, this beautiful conifer, our tallest tree to date, say 10, 11 feet tall. For those listening from afar, you may picture the tree in the northeast corner of the nave, just before the lectern and the organ, and our chaplains and our choir. It took 6 men and a boy to carry this into the sanctuary, for it was laden with ice and snow, and a further hour or 3 to let it melt and dry out. And then, and from that moment, there wafted through Marsh Chapel, here in the nave, but also and more so downstairs, the fragrance, aroma, perfume, scent, pine needle grace of a new season. Could it be that the advent of a new season might bring to you, might bring among us, a healing grace? Is it possible that the arrival of this beautiful star-capped tree might shift just a bit the way, by grace, we are going to live? We surely could receive with gladness such a transformation. We live in challenging times, do we not? Our climate is in catastrophe. Our government is in an uproar. According to our paper of record, 3 of 4 Americans cannot name the 3 branches of government: executive, legislative, judicial. That makes for a difficult time in conversation about balance of power. Our denomination in tatters. Our workplaces, both human and divine, but more human than divine. And today and tomorrow and the day after, papers to complete, exams to write, semester to conclude, and our families under duress. Since OxyContin was approved in 1995, there have been 200,000 opioid-related deaths in this country. From 2007 to 2017, the incidence of self-hurt to young adults, 10 to 24, has increased by 56%. And on top of it all, the existential challenges, maladies of breakfast and dinner, of getting up and finishing the day. Could it be that this seasonal intervention, this beautiful tree and its fragrance, might shift us just a little bit? Now, we are in Advent. You recognize that the gospel read earlier is from the 11th chapter of Matthew. No, John the Baptist appeared earlier, but here, mid-gospel, he speaks again. Jesus is recorded in Matthew 10 as giving all manner of instruction to disciples on how to be, well, disciples, and how to evangelize, and how to give stewardship, and how to teach, and how to preach, where to go, where not to go, how to live. And then there's a pause, and the precursor, the predecessor, literally in his case, John the Baptist, emerges again, kind of like a fragrant evergreen, bringing its presence, its scent among us. Advent in memory and hope is a time for us to remember those who came before, those who preceded us, our precursors. Jesus had precursors. Even Jesus had precursors, especially, notably, John the Baptist, whose narrative is a reminder of judgment and redemption, including the cross itself. We don't get to the manger without a moment along the river bank. We don't get to hearth and warmth and cattle lowing and mother and child without the voice of the Baptist, "You brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come." Without that precursor, that Advent interruption. Not all religious traditions are quite as good at Advent as others. My own beloved history in Methodism has sometimes skipped a bit over Advent. This week, one of our seminary presidents sent me a note saying, "Let me greet you this Advent day. Let me greet you this Advent week. Let me greet you in Advent, Bob, in good Methodist fashion by saying, Merry Christmas to you." We don't always pause, do we, to listen for the voices of those who came before us, who shaped us. My great aunt Hazel, who raised my father, she and her husband, my uncle Bob, were childless, and they raised my dad in that home. At Christmas, she baked pies and taught him to bake pies. She grew up right along the St. Lawrence River in northern New York State, where, as she said, you could look down into Canada. Baking the pies, it is recalled, my father would tug on her apron and ask strange questions. He, who would later study theology, asked her, "Where was I before I was born?" And she didn't respond. And again, "Where was I before I was born?" And she was irritated. And when the question came a third time, she finished the crust on that pie and said, "Down in Canada, boiling soap. That's where you were before you were born." One December, she found me glum and asked, "Did your girlfriend give you the wet mitten?" Now, I didn't know what she meant because I didn't understand the reference, plus I didn't know she knew I had a girlfriend, which I barely did. But she was right. There had been a little bit of an argument. The image, in case you miss it, is of people on a sleigh or a wagon and enjoying the outdoors and the snow falling and happiness and joy and cuddling and kissing, and then somebody rejects the other with that forceful instrument, a wet mitten. Off you go. It's a compelling image. And it was the case. She was right. Well, you know, though we still managed to have 43 years of pretty happy marriage, wet mitten or no, and the lesson was there, life goes on. This may be a despond moment this Advent season, but life will carry on for you. Our memories the ornament of memory, the light of hope. The ornament of memory in Matthew, the light of hope in Isaiah, are partly particular and diverse and all our own. And we need that diversity, each one holding her own. Sometimes, though, they are more unifying, universal, binding. For us to have diversity, we're going to need unity. For us to have unity, we're going to need diversity. Wednesday night, a woman came to me and said, let me place myself in your memory. I was glad for that. She said, a dozen years ago, you came to the university Christmas party, and you didn't know what you were going to find, and I remember it. It was a Wednesday afternoon, 3:30, and I walked into the darkened student center. And people were glad and greeting, but with a little touch of extra happiness. And there was sort of a path that opened up to where the sleds, 10 of them each year in competition, were placed. And there was a friend guiding me by the elbow. And I got to the front, and there, right in the middle, I think it won the prize that year, was Marsh Chapel. A sled made of gingerbread and licorice and chocolate and candy and the unifying memory of the centrality, the architectural, historic, spiritual, religious, locational centrality of Marsh Chapel to this community through a rhythm, a ritual of making sleds. She said, we took a picture remembering how moved you were. It was a welcome moment, December of 2007. And there, made out in little bits of candy, were words you've come to cherish, a unifying memory. When the song of the angels is stilled, and the star in the sky is gone, and the kings and princes are home, and the shepherds are back with their flocks, then the work of Christmas begins to find the lost, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to visit the prisoner, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among brothers and sisters, to make music in the heart. Carlisle Marnie used to ask, he put it in a funny way, who told you who you was? I want to ask you about that this morning in Advent. Who came before you? Predecessor, precursor, ornament in memory, as in Matthew. Advent is one part memory and one part hope. Did you listen to the passage from Isaiah 35? Really, its origins are with the second part of Isaiah, most probably. Its aspirations, its hopes, so improbable, as we heard last week from Isaiah 2, they shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy hill, saith the Lord. Seems so improbable where we sit. And yet, there they are. Then shall the eyes of the blind be opened, and the ears of the deaf be unstopped. Say to those who are of tender heart, be strong, fear not, your God will come and save you. There are waters that will flow in the wilderness, and streams in the desert, and weeping and sighing shall be no more. Advent is a time to recapture a sense of hope. These are diverse and particular and even idiosyncratic, those moments of hope, those people who came into life and guided you toward a better place, a newer, world. For us, some years ago, in 2 years of his preaching ministry at Riverside Church in New York City, we were there for his first Sunday, and continued to enjoy his ministry, including piano and music and fellowship in his home, was William Sloan Coffin, of blessed memory. He who could speak out of his earlier life and experience to corporate America, to business America, to governmental and cultural leadership, and also after several years at Bechtel Chapel at Yale capacity, with real integrity to speak in a scholastic and in an academic way too. He was an epigrammatist and gave particular hope. I carry his voice every day on faith. Faith is being grasped by the power of love. On truth. Faith gives us the strength to face unpleasant truth. On will. The rational mind is no match for the irrational will. On justice. Pastoral care for the rich must be matched and overmatched by prophetic concern for the poor. On sin, sin is a state of being, and when the triangle God, neighbor, and self is sundered, there you fall into that state. On prejudice, white racism, straight homophobia, male chauvinism. These exist because the things sometimes that are unspoken become most influential. He also could be a bit acerbic. A book was published in those years titled I'm Okay, You're Okay, and the reporter asked his view of the tome, and he said, I don't agree with it. Well, the reporter said, why not? Aren't you okay? Aren't I okay? And he said, no. What do you think, Mr. Coffin? And he said, here's the gospel. I'm not okay. And you're not okay. But that's okay. He married his third wife, Arthur Rubinstein's daughter. And the great musician was heard to say, I'm glad my daughter's happy, but I wish she hadn't picked some Billy Graham. To which Coffin replied, I'm glad she's happy too, but I wish her father-in-law weren't some Liberace. In other words, he could be sharp. Even to preachers, he would say, preachers, be careful. You are egotists with a theological alibi. But you know, when his fairly young son died in a tragic accident, not far from here, by the way, if memory serves. I hold this every day. He said, yes, my heart is broken, but let me tell you, God's heart was the first to break. In hope, there are voices that have guided you to this point. They're diverse, they're particular, they're yours, perhaps nobody else's. But there are also some great unifying hopes. Some of you will have seen displayed on the great screen the story of Fred Rogers recently. Beautiful film. He who, by the way, this isn't mentioned, so I add a footnote, was a religious person. He was a Presbyterian minister, Fred Rogers, trained at the Pittsburgh School of Pittsburgh Theological Seminary in that Calvinist creed, a little bit chilly, but good for Advent. And in the film, you see his practice of ministry, memorable for those of us day by day entering the ministry. He rose and read scripture, not just historically, critically, and analytically, but personally, spiritually, and devotionally. That's good. He visited in home and workplace. In third place, those in need. That's good. He prayed for people with a list by name, day by day. That's good. With his wife on another piano, he played, forehand piano they played, every other day for the nourishment in beauty of the Spirit. That's good. He conversed in person, by telephone, in group, individually, listening and speaking, healing, healing, healing. And he gave saving hope. You know, we discovered the copy this week of his sermon given from this pulpit in May of 1992. Mr. Rogers spoke for 22 minutes, and everything in the film is captured there, by the way. And at the end, he asked what I'm going to ask you right now. Who told you who you were, who believed in you, who loved you, who shaped you? What one person can you remember with generosity, whose own generosity fed you, guided you to this point? The adventure of Advent is ornament and light, both memory and hope, both in diverse and unifying forms. So in this moment, I ask you, who do you recall with gratitude who believed in you, who shaped you, who gave you space to become who you are?